We have a special welcome for students from Ripon College. Would they please step?
Very nice.
And their instructor?
How are you?
Well, we don't usually see you in that capacity. Please be seated. And we have a Department of Justice intern. Would they stand, please? And we're delighted to see you all. Tell us where you're from.
I'm from the University of Wisconsin Law School, originally from Harrison, New York.
I'm also from the University of Wisconsin Law School, and I'm from Hollywood, Hollywood.
What are you doing here? We'll get you tested. Well, good. Welcome to you all. Thank you for bringing the interns. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start with my far left, and it is Justice Gableman, and the group may meet with Justice Gableman right after this argument, and the discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in this case. The session is open to everyone who wishes to join, not only the students. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right is Justice Annette Siegler. Now that we've made these introductions, I will call our first and only case today and our last case in April and perhaps through till next September, 07AP 795, State versus Aaron Antonio Allen. Representing Mr. Allen is Robert Hennick. And Mr. Hennick is pro bono counsel appointed by the court. You may proceed, Mr. Hennick.
Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Robert Hennick and I do represent Aaron Allen in this appeal. The issue before the court is whether the lower courts correctly decided that Mr. Allen had waived his right to challenge the effectiveness of post-conviction counsel for the simple reason that he failed to respond with that objection in response to that counsel's no-merit report. Alternatively stated, whether Mr. Allen has shown sufficient reason to raise now that issue of ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel under the requirements of Escalon and Araño and Wisconsin Statute Section 97406, sub 4. Now, it might be easiest to clarify what is not at issue first. First, contrary to what may be suggested in the state's brief, there is no challenge here to Escalon and Araño or its interpretation of 97406 sub 4.
What does that mean?
What that means is that we are not questioning whether 97406 sub 4 applies in this case, but rather the question is how it applies in this case.
Okay, well then, what does Escalona say that you're not challenging?
Exactly. What Escalona and Araño decided is that the requirements of 97406 sub 4, the limitations in that statute on the kind of issues that can be raised in a 97406 motion after a direct appeal, apply even to a where the prior appeal or post-conviction motion was under 80930. Or a direct appeal as opposed to a prior 97406 motion. Prior to Escalon and Araño in Bergenthal, the court had held basically that as long as the issue is a constitutional or jurisdictional issue, the defendant can raise that in a 97406 motion, even if he could have raised it on the direct appeal. Escalona held, no, that is not correct. As long as there was one prior attempt at relief, whether it was a direct appeal, whether it was a 80930 motion, whether it was a 97406 motion, you have to meet the requirements of sub 4.
Go ahead. Counsel, then, in shorthand, what you're talking about is in the Escalona case, there was the majority and the dissent, and the majority and dissent disagreed with regard to the interpretation of the sentence and what that sentence applied to. Did it apply to prior 80930 and 02 direct appeal, or does it apply to a prior 97406 as we have here? And so you're not contesting that. You're not taking the dissent's point of view. That's what you're saying.
Right. I raised that in Mr. Lowe's case, and the courts disagreed with me there. I may bat my head against the wall, but I know when to stop hitting it against the wall. I think in this case, what we need to do is deal with the fact that Escalona and Lowe are controlling and instead address how they apply in the particular case.
So they're controlling it, as I read it in a broad sense. If you came to court in either 97406 or direct appeal, you had to raise all the issues then. If you didn't, you forfeited it, unless you come in the last sentence that you can raise it again. Is that a correct statement of your position on Escalona?
Yes, that if you show sufficient reason,
that's right,
under the statute.
So you accept that you're out unless you raised it, unless you show sufficient reason. So the question here is, did Allen show sufficient reason? Is that
exactly
right? Okay.
Exactly. The other issue that is not in dispute, that might otherwise be seen as possibly in dispute, is whether Escalona and 97406 sub 4 apply where the initial proceeding was a no-merit proceeding under 809.32. And Tillman decided that. We are not disputing that. A no-merit appeal is an appeal. The question then is whether Allen has shown sufficient reason, or the flip side, the way that the state tries to present this, is whether he waived his right to present these issues.
Mr. Hennick, what is the sufficient reason that you're claiming will avoid the bar of Escalona here?
There are actually four of them. Three of them would apply specifically to the facts of this case. One is a much broader conceptual reading of what sufficient reason should be. First is ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. Under the Rothering decision, which I understand the state is not challenging here, ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel can be a sufficient reason under sub 4. The United States Supreme Court in Smith, in the Smith decision, held that in a no-merit appeal, that ineffectiveness is shown, at least the deficient performance prong of ineffectiveness is shown where the defendant can point to at least one arguably meritorious issue
counsel,
that the attorney missed.
I don't want to interrupt your four reasons because I want to hear them. But as you address them, maybe you can make clear for me what it is you're seeking. Are you seeking a Mockner hearing at the trial court level? Are you seeking relief at the court of, what exactly are you asking us to do and why?
Okay, I can clarify that. The original post-conviction motion was an ineffectiveness claim, so there has to be a Mockner hearing on that if the court allows Mr. Allen to proceed. And that's true whether or not it's trial level ineffectiveness, which is kind of included within the post-conviction ineffectiveness claim, or whether it's the post-conviction ineffectiveness. There has to be a hearing where the attorney can present his or her reasons why he took the actions that they did.
So you're asking for now Judge Ashley to come back and testify what he did, why he did it as trial counsel, and have a trial court make a ruling on that. That's what you want from us?
Yes,
today.
Ultimately, yes.
Okay.
Yes. The sufficient reasons, that first one, which is the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel, would require a Mockner hearing. The second issue, or the second sufficient reason, would not require a Mockner hearing, and that is the standard under the federal Wilkinson v. Cohen standard that the Court of Appeals effectively adopted in Fortier and Tillman as indicating that that would be sufficient reason. And under that standard, the Seventh Circuit held that if the defendant in a no-merit appeal was not advised that his failure to respond would result in waiver, then you cannot force him, or you cannot then deem his failure to respond a waiver.
Now, do you view that as one of the narrowest holdings, then,
Yes.
in this case?
Yes.
Because it would only cover a no merit.
Yes.
You're at least as to number one, and I want you to complete Justice Crooks's question. At least as to one, ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel would apply if you had appointed counsel that did fight rather than file a no merit.
Right. The Rothering standard applies whenever there is post-conviction counsel, whether it's no merit, whether it's a meritorious brief, whether they just abandon the client. Yes.
Follow up Justice Ziegler's question. You say Mockner hearings will be required. The trial was in 1999?
Yes.
Is counsel available? Suppose hypothetically counsel were dead.
The Court of Appeals has addressed that issue. It's not obviously not in any of the briefs, but the Court of Appeals addressed that issue, and I believe that the way that they resolve that, where the counsel is either dead or unavailable for some other reason, that the defendant has to point to something other than the defendant's own testimony or own statements to try to give the court a basis to determine the reasoning of the trial attorney in taking the actions or omitting an objection, things like that. So the court can make a determination of that. The court still has to make a determination on the reasonableness of the defense attorney's conduct, but when the attorney is dead, obviously that becomes a lot more difficult. What the Court of Appeals has held is just that the defendant can't rely on his own testimony alone to establish that the lawyer was ineffective.
It's now 11 years after the conviction. Should Mr. Allen have to show a reason why he didn't bring these things up in a response to the no merit report?
Well, the issues here, actually, we are, the sufficient reasons here, in fact, we are trying to show why he didn't do that. I think that's incorporated within the sufficient reason requirement, and that would have to be done regardless whether it was 1 year, 6 months, or 20 years.
So 20 years, according to your formulation of this case, of what you're asking us to do here, 20 years would be just fine for him to bring this motion as well.
97406, unlike the Knight petition, for instance, we can compare these and contrast them to a Knight petition. A Knight petition, there is the latches issue that you're referring to, which is that after a certain period of time, if the opposing party...
Right, so according to you, 7 years, 11 years, 20 yes. years, it's
yes.
all fine.
Whatever. The latches would apply to an equitable remedy in a Knight petition. This, however, is a statutory remedy. The statutory remedy, there is nothing in the statute that indicates that there is any kind of a deadline. And as I understand it, this court has never applied a deadline to 97406 motions.
If I agree with your conclusion that because Mr. Allen was not told that if he didn't respond to the no merit report, even though he did get notice that he could respond, that he would have waived his opportunity for any further review, how many other defendants who have not responded to a no merit report would be affected by our ruling?
Actually, there will be quite a lot, and I have to be honest with you on that, and there is a reason for that, and there's a reason why that should not matter to the court, because the fact that a number of individuals have been denied the right, in this case, to counsel, should be something that the court should be concerned about, not because it may raise a number of cases before the court, but because there are a number of people that have been denied their rights, and this court should be concerned about that. Which brings me to the third.
Well, they have the right to counsel. You're just arguing to us, I believe, that they had the right to counsel, but he's saying counsel was not effective.
Well, there, those are two separate. Let me just, if I could.
Sure.
The sufficient reasons. Number one is the ineffectiveness. Number two is that he was not advised that this would be a waiver, so therefore it can't be a waiver.
Right, that's what I was
third, thinking. Third, and the most, and I think probably the one that I would like to rely on most here, is the Fortier decision and the Fortier analysis, which is that we have a no-merit procedure for a reason. That is to protect a defendant because an individual charged with a crime cannot be expected to protect his or her own rights. That's why we have the no-merit procedure. They need a lawyer to protect them. That's what Evitz v. Lucey says, U.S. Supreme Court. We cannot expect an individual to protect his or her own rights. Yet, what the state is arguing for here, and if we find waiver here, what we are essentially saying is that when that no-merit procedure is applied and the lawyer misses an issue, the defendant, we are attributing to the defendant a greater level of legal sophistication than the lawyer who missed the issue and the Court of Appeals that missed the issue. We are attributing to that lawyer the ability to raise an issue that the law, that the attorney.
Well, that's the same thing that we attribute to a defendant whose lawyer did not file a no-merit appeal, argued it vigorously, and sometime later the defendant decided that lawyer should have raised another issue. We apply Escalona every day to those. So you're treating people in similarly situated in regard to what the lawyer didn't do very dissimilarly by your argument.
Actually, they are not in a similar situation. A person who has a lawyer who raises meritorious claims on appeal is not in the same situation as a defendant who has insisted on his right to appeal, has insisted on his right to counsel on the appeal, has insisted that he wants to go ahead with the direct appeal, not hold off on something till later.
Sure.
That person is entitled to the assistance of counsel, and this only applies when there, in fact, is a meritorious issue that the lawyer missed. And the reason why that makes a difference is, again, because the purpose of the no-merit appeal is to protect the defendant, not to use in a sick game of gotcha if the defendant doesn't come up with an issue that the lawyer and the court missed.
Well, he doesn't really have to come up with an issue. All I understand he has to do is to file a letter saying he doesn't agree with counsel's argument and wants the court to look at it in a little different light. I don't think he really has to identify another legal issue, but what we're looking at here is someone that didn't respond in any way, didn't say agreed or disagreed or anything.
Exactly. But again, keep in mind that we are not talking about someone who is intentionally hiding an issue. Remember that Escalon and Arango.
Well, I'm not
focus.
I don't think that hiding an issue is where I see anybody arguing here. I think what you're up against really is the finality that Escalona provides for someone who you say is not similarly situated to someone who's had a direct appeal and that counsel did not raise an argument that the defendant now believes should have been raised.
And what right. We have to keep in mind on Escalona is that it did not assert finality above all things. It asserted finality unless the defendant can show a sufficient reason.
Right, I understand.
And that's the balance that the legislature made in 1969, which takes me actually to the fourth issue, which is just conceptually, what does sufficient reason mean? And to do that, the issue isn't what I as a lawyer now in 2010 or the prosecutor or this court in 2010 may view as the proper balance, but what did the legislature in 1969 decide was the proper balance? Because we're talking about legislative interpretation. We're not talking about something where this is common law, where the court can just impose its best views on current standards of how finality and fairness to the defendant should be balanced. But how did the legislature back in 1969, and in the context of 1969, make that balance?
So how did they?
I'm sorry?
So how did they?
They, according to the best evidence we have, which is that they adopted Section 8 of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedures Act, which, as this court pointed out in Escalona and in Lowe, the purposes of that act follow through to the purposes of 97406 sub 4. And what we know from the commissioner's note on that act is that the sufficient reason requirement was intended to impose a similar kind of liberality in terms of post-conviction motions, successive post-conviction motions, as was then required by the Supreme Court in Sanders and Fay. And that the reason for that is that a number of cases were going to the federal courts without having the states first having an opportunity to resolve those issues and actually grant relief where it was merited. And that's in the note to Section 8, that's in my brief. And it wasn't until some 8 years later that the United States Supreme Court changed Sanders and Fay and implemented the cause and prejudice standard under Wainwright v. Sykes. So the legislature certainly did not intend the cause and prejudice standard. They intended, as this court said in Lowe and Escalona, the same purpose that Section 8 was.
Well, what I hear you saying is that any time the Court of Appeals or trial court thinks there's arguable merit to what the defendant is saying, even if the defendant could have raised it earlier, give him a shot. Is that what you're interpreting the statute to mean?
No, not generally, no. What the statute means, at least in the first 97406 motion, is that if the defendant, if the issue was not resolved in the first appeal.
That means it wasn't raised.
Yeah, if it wasn't raised,
right.
Then the defendant should be able to raise it in a first 97406 as long as that defendant did not know about the issue and intentionally failed to raise it.
Well, what if he's already had a 97406 and it wasn't raised there?
That I haven't looked into the how the federal courts addressed that in 1969 under the Fay and Sanders standards. I believe that a very good argument could be raised or could be made that in a second 97406, the balance should be different. And I'm not arguing here that the Fay-Sanders standard should apply, you know, to the 10th 97406 standard, because the balance would be different in those circumstances.
Well, because here you have a direct appeal, right?
Yes.
And then followed by a 97406. So that's the only thing you're arguing under 4.
Yes.
Right. If you have a direct appeal and the counsel, appointed counsel, does not make an argument, can you, on a 97406 now, raise ineffective assistance to counsel?
Yes.
Not barred by Escalona?
Correct.
So if you have a direct appeal and a 97406 and there's no merit, there's a no merit filed, right? And now the defendant wants to raise ineffective assistance of counsel, trial court and on appeal, the appellate court or 97406 counsel. Now, under present law, is the defendant barred by Escalona?
In a first 97406 motion?
Well, let's take the first 97406.
Okay, first 97406 motion, no, I do not believe that it is barred by Escalona.
Under what?
Under the that no court has ever said that there is a difference there. In a published decision. Tillman certainly didn't say that. Fortier says just the opposite, that if a defendant fails to identify an issue that counsel and the court also fail to identify in a no merit, then he's entitled to raise it because it's fundamentally unfair and contrary to the right to the assistance of counsel.
Let's take it out of no merit.
Okay.
I want to have full counsel, goes through appeal, goes through 974-06, never raises an issue. Let's just say it has, looks like it has some merit. Mm-hmm. Not frivolous on its face, okay? Is the defendant barred from raising it again on 974-06, assuming it's constitutional, et cetera, constitutional issue?
In a second 974-06, we have to address why the defendant didn't raise it on a direct appeal, also why it wasn't raised in the 974-06 motion.
Right. Okay.
It's kind of like embedded hearsay. You have to meet the hearsay exceptions for each of them. In this, when we talk about the initial no merit appeal, there's sufficient reason for not having it raised then.
What's the sufficient reason?
For the original no merit appeal?
Yeah.
Any of those four that I talked about.
So you say if there's a charge of ineffective assistance of counsel, that's sufficient reason.
That's sufficient reason to get beyond why it wasn't raised in the no merit appeal. The first 974-06 motion. If it wasn't raised there, the defendant has to show sufficient reason why he or she didn't raise it in the 974-06 motion as well.
Okay. So here's my basic question. I raised it with you before, but I'll raise it again. In a case such as Allen, where you have a direct appeal, appointed counsel, no merit report, trial court and court of appeals hold no merit. You then get you don't have a 974-06. Then the defendant, 7 years later, raises a 974-06, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the question that the state says is, you forfeited your right, Mr. Defendant. Okay. How would you write this opinion in the narrowest way to support your client?
Well, the narrowest legal standard would be that since
which
Mr.
standard?
Allen was not notified.
The Wilkinson Cone,
yes,
Frontier Tillman. Number two in your hit parade. Number two in your answer to Justice Gross.
Yes. The second most narrow standard would be the 40A standard, which also is consistent with Page v. Frank, the constitutional issue that you cannot expect a defendant to know more than the lawyer.
That's number three.
Yes.
Okay. Second narrowest, okay. And that's the one you said you preferred.
Yes.
Okay.
The third narrowest would be the ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel, because that only applies where the lawyer actually makes a mistake. And obviously, a number of times, a lawyer does not raise things under Jones v. Barnes on direct appeal for adequate reasons. So that would be the third. And then the fourth would be more of this conceptual, what it means under sufficient reason. And
number four would cover both merit, no merit reports, and
yes.
Counsel that.
And so would three. One and two would only apply to no merit reports.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions, Mr. Henning? Okay, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Gansner.
I feel like saying I'm here to represent the state, and I wish I was from Hawaii.
Don't we all?
I appear here on behalf of the one participant in the criminal justice process who does not have an actual institutional role in the no merit procedure, the state of Wisconsin. As I suspect all the members of the court are aware, the no merit process is one in which appointed counsel for the indigent defendant, if after evaluating all of the records and the law, the facts and the law of the case, determines that there are no non-frivolous issues that could be raised on an appeal or, presumably, by a post-conviction motion under 80930, because, of course, the appointed counsel is appointed to serve both as post-conviction counsel in the bringing of any post-trial motion to assert new facts or new evidence that would support a claim, facts that were not otherwise appearing in the record of the trial, or appeal. If counsel determines that there is no merit to further proceedings, counsel files a no-merit report. Required by our statute, 80932, enacted and subsequently modified in the wake of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Anders and in recognition of some subsequent decisions of the United States Supreme Court discussing the procedure, that report filed by counsel, by defense counsel, is to identify any potential issues in the case and discuss, under Wisconsin's statutory discussion requirement, why counsel believes further proceedings are not warranted, why these are not issues worthy of pursuing, why these issues do not qualify as non-frivolous, why they are not something that should be pursued. That report is not served upon the state.
Is it served on the district attorney?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. My experience with public defenders, in particular with appointed counsel, has been that they jealously guard the content of the no merit report. There's no requirement that it be served on any representative of the state.
That's what I read your brief to indicate.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Because the DA represents the state, too.
And the DA does not see it. It's filed at the Court of Appeals. It's not filed at the circuit court level. So the state does not see it. The state does not have, under the statute or in decisional authority from this court, any role in responding to it.
The state merely sees
the opinion that the court ultimately issues.
Why should the state care? Because the defendant is throwing in the towel.
Precisely. I'm not complaining. I'm not asking for it. Please believe me. We've been more than happy during the existence of 80932 not to be involved in that process. And frankly, I don't think the involvement of the state in any kind of adversarial role in the no merit process would in all comport with what the United States Supreme Court said in Anders was the purpose of the procedure. I'm simply pointing out we don't have an institutional role there. Our interest in this case, as a result, is an interest in two things. One, the state's general interest in ensuring that challenges to convictions are fairly adjudicated, which is a role that the judicial system of the state takes extremely seriously. And two, in the area where we do become involved, in ensuring that there is not an endless series of repeated challenges to convictions once, in our view, finality has been achieved in the case by the affirmance of a conviction on a direct appeal.
I just want to, at this stage, say one, Justice Bradley calls my attention to the fact that on March 13, 2000, when defense counsel filed with the Court of Appeals the no merit report, a carbon copy did go to Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke. That's neither here nor there, as far as I'm concerned, but they did that.
Does that appear on the submission to the Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's probably in the correspondence file.
I apologize. That was intentional misstatement on my part.
Your argument regarding institutional interests, though,
right,
still
is the same. Yeah. That's my point.
Thank you. Is an unusual event.
That may be. And it's irrelevant because there's a total concession why the state would care would be irrelevant,
right,
unless the Court of Appeals said something in their decision that the state objected to, and it would be published, which is unusual too, then the state might seek reconsideration of the Court of Appeals or come up here, which they've done, even though they might have won, but feel that there's been harm done. So I just point that out, that
no.
I'm sure that sometimes you're advised, sometimes you're not.
Yeah. It is, in my experience, extremely rare for that to occur. I apologize for having been unaware of that.
It's not a relevant
factor. And please believe me when I say we are not seeking to have a formal role in this process.
You don't want to. The less you know here, the better, right? But I want to ask you the same question I've asked the defendant. What kind of opinion do you think the court, how would you write the opinion? How does the state write the opinion? Would you write as the Court of Appeals did and the Circuit Court did, Escalona, you're gone. You had an opportunity to raise it in this no merit. You didn't. Too bad.
In the absence of a showing of sufficient reason.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, this is what bothered me in dissent in Escalona, is instead of fighting out the merits, whether counsel blew it here or not, we are now fighting out sufficient reason, you know, and we don't get to the guts of this and why are we doing that, but that's neither here nor there. So we'll fight out sufficient reason. What? Now, the sufficient reason here, according to the defendant, is he's arguing ineffective assistance of counsel.
Post-conviction counsel.
On a post-conviction, first 97406. And you're holding him to a higher standard than the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, none of whom recognize what he says is arguably merit ineffective assistance of counsel. Is that sufficient reason in your opinion?
The ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel?
Yeah.
If demonstrated.
How do you demonstrate it?
Well, in the same fashion that in non-no merit cases now, where a post-conviction motion is brought and an appeal follows from an unsuccessful post-conviction motion and an appeal from conviction, or in cases where no post-conviction motion is brought by post-conviction counsel and an appeal follows. A defendant, it is not uncommon, in fact it is far too common from the state's viewpoint, for defendants thereafter, after an unsuccessful direct appeal, to bring a 97406 motion saying, under Rothering, and that's precisely what the Rothering case says the defendant can do, file a 97406 motion challenging the effectiveness of post-conviction counsel. They filed that Rothering motion in the Circuit Court. If their claim is my post-conviction counsel failed to file a motion in the Circuit Court challenging, for instance, to make it pertinent to this case, the effectiveness of trial counsel, okay, or they may file under State versus Knight a habeas corpus petition in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals if their claim is my post-conviction slash appellate counsel failed on appeal to pursue an argument that was preserved that I think was meritorious. And in those proceedings, the defendant has an opportunity, has an obligation, if he or she is to prevail, to allege and then establish what the ineffectiveness was,
counsel,
both deficient performance and prejudice. And if I could just conclude in this one sentence, in our case, in this case, while neither the state nor the defendant ever reached at the circuit court level in this case the merits of Mr. Allen's claims. The allegation of post-conviction counsel ineffectiveness here in this case is, in our view, woefully deficient. He doesn't allege facts that, if established at some kind of hearing, which the circuit court would be authorized to conduct, or the Court of Appeals could have been authorized to remand for, he hasn't alleged any facts which, if proven, would have shown that his post-conviction counsel was ineffective. More than 7 years after his conviction, when he filed his motion, he included in his motion no facts whatsoever as to why his post-conviction counsel did or did not do what Mr. Allen says he should have done, challenge the effectiveness of trial counsel. He certainly had time to have discussed the matter with counsel and to have been able to allege something, facts pertinent to that, if proven, could have established deficient performance. As in, I've discussed this matter with my post-conviction counsel, and he chose not to challenge the effectiveness of trial counsel for this reason. And that's an irrational reason. That's an unreasonable reason. Or perhaps his contact with post-conviction counsel might have revealed, I didn't file that post-conviction motion challenging the effectiveness of trial counsel because I didn't think there was any arguable merit to a challenge to the effectiveness of trial counsel. If that were the case, of course, and he alleged that in his motion, the motion would have been sunk immediately, as it should have. I mean, it seems to me that this relates to a question that Justice Gableman asked before about, we've waited a number of years here. There has been a considerable passage of time. What do we know now that we didn't know then?
Counsel.
And no facts with respect to that have ever been alleged by this defendant.
I haven't waited a number of years, but I've waited a number of seconds now, so
yes,
I'm going
sorry.
To. That's okay. So I get your position, and it seems to me it's this. With regard to ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes.
No problem if the defendant does not file a response to the no merit. Defendant doesn't have to file a response to the no merit.
Correct.
As long as there is sufficient reason alleged. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so our fight here really is what has to be in the pleading and what constitutes sufficient reason.
Right.
In page 26 of your brief, you touch upon the very things you were just advancing. What has to be in the pleading? What factual allegations need be made? And I see at least two things popping out on that last paragraph on page 26. One is, you say, Allen might have included his former attorney's no merit report with his motion.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting that that should be a requirement then in order to have a sufficient 974-06 motion that there be attached a copy of the former attorney's no merit report?
No, I was not necessarily suggesting that that be made a requirement. I had in mind that would have provided some additional factual information that was not otherwise provided by the motion. I'm not suggesting that it ought to be, but frankly, if I was the circuit court initially reviewing the 974-06 motion, and the claim was my counsel was ineffective in how he handled my no merit report, I think I'd like to see it.
The other thing that you have in that last paragraph is, and you commented on this earlier, Allen might have communicated with his former counsel, might have asked about his reasoning and his evaluation of a possible appellate or post-conviction issue, and then he might have included this factual information in his motion. Are you asserting then that absent that kind of description of the events of the conversation that a 974-06 motion would be deficient?
Once again, I was not suggesting, I was using that as an example of information that could assist, that could allege facts which might support a claim of deficient performance. What I am not suggesting, I did not mean to argue that that should necessarily be a requirement, but what should be a requirement is that the defendant allege some facts which, if proven, would show, if established by a testimony, would demonstrate that defense counsel's performance was unprofessional and unreasonable. If we know nothing about why counsel did or didn't do what he is being challenged for doing or not doing, the court and the circuit court and the appellate court, everyone is in the dark.
Let me tell you a concern that came to mind.
Yes.
This, because it sounds a little bit to me like a Bangert deficient or defective colloquy.
Okay.
And that is that there are certain things that need be asserted in order to get to first base. Not only was there a defective colloquy, but that you didn't otherwise, the other thing that has to be asserted is that you did not otherwise know the stuff. And without both of those, you can't have your Bangert hearing. My concern is this, that if there are pleading requirements, which on one hand makes sense, you know, why not? But in this context, the person is necessarily pro se. Unlike in a Bangert hearing, when they file a Bangert motion, you've got an attorney generally, you know, they've read the law, they know they have to do this two-prong thing, defective colloquy, and you didn't otherwise know. How is a pro se person going to know that if he doesn't set forth certain things in this 974-06 motion, it will be considered an inadequate motion that could proceed further? I mean, how do you take care of that problem?
Well, this court, over the past 10 years at least, has spent longer time than that. I'm compressing time. It happens as I get older. Has spent a considerable amount of time defining what adequate pleadings in the post-conviction motion context are. I mean, Bentley talks about the sufficiency of post-conviction motion pleadings. This court has spent a great deal of time talking about those circumstances in which an inadequately pled motion can result in summary denial. Otherwise,
I think I may have written Bentley, but those you know, the passage of time kind of compresses my memory too. But those situations, whether it's colloquy or non-colloquy situations, have involved an attorney. This necessarily, quintessentially, is pro se.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And he is also pro se at two responses. It's understood that he is pro se. To place this in the context, again, of where we started, the no merit procedure. Anders understood that the defendant is pro se when he has the opportunity to respond to his appointed attorney's no merit report. Anders said to ensure that the indigent defendant receives this, what we believe ought to be the same quality of representation that the defendant with money to retain an attorney has, we want to make sure that the appointed attorney has done his or her work. If that attorney says, I don't think this case has any merit, file a report telling us so. And then give a copy to the defendant, and the defendant has the opportunity to respond, as the court said in Anders, in any manner he chooses, with whatever intellectual means and other capabilities he may possess. We know from this defendant that a number of years after his conviction, he filed a lengthy, coherent, well-cited, well-written post-conviction motion. It's in the appendix. I believe it's 17 or 18 pages long. It reads well.
Cases. Mm-hmm.
And I have no reason to believe, and there has been no suggestion here, that this defendant was incapable of asserting a claim of ineffective assistance of
trial counsel. Can I just interrupt and ask a question? We've got a file here that relates to this case.
Yes.
And it's pretty thick. But you know what it says on top of it? It says separate box. You know what that tells me?
Mm-hmm. There's a trial transcript.
Yeah, and not a simple trial transcript that can be placed into this red manila folder, or even another red manila folder, and maybe even a third manila folder, but there's enough in there to put it in a box. Did this defendant have all of that available to him in prison?
Did he have all of those records?
Yes.
I don't know. And in all honesty, I will acknowledge, Mr. Hennig's, we had a discussion in advance of the argument today, and I realize something now, thanks to Rob, that at the time of the no merit procedure in this case, 80932 did not contain a requirement, as it does now, providing that appointed counsel was to provide to the client copies of the transcripts and records. I don't know whether he did or not. That's another relevant fact.
I know, but that's just another way of asking Justice Bradley's question of what burden you're putting on an unrepresented defendant who more times than not is going to be in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So you got access problems,
maybe.
You got costs of transcripts, maybe, et cetera. And so what burden do you put on him? Now, the court has a number of cases that say, if you're pro se, you're held to the same standards as counsel, because we can't have two different standards. You might be better off without counsel if we give you a lower standard, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, and then we have a ton of cases that say, yeah, but once you're pro se, whatever you do is liberally construed to help you, in effect, right? So, and they don't quite fit together. So, I tell you, I read your brief, and I marked the pages, and I kept reading it to say, hey, you had a direct appeal here. If you didn't put in this argument, you are out.
Absent a sufficient demonstration of a sufficient reason for your failure to have done.
But it's, I can't find really what the state recognizes as a sufficient reason absent a total explanation. Now, the defendant here said, if I got it right, his three issues that he said trial counsel failed to raise and then that weren't raised at post-conviction, that he didn't suppress the fruits of Allen's unlawful arrest. That wasn't raised before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't seek to suppress the illegal lineup and resulting in-court identification. That's close to something that was raised, but not precisely.
Exactly.
Three, did not object to the prosecutor's use of Allen's conduct at the lineup as evidence of a consciousness of guilt. I viewed that as closer to what was raised.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe three really was raised. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to go back through and carefully look at the no merit report again. One wasn't raised at all.
Mm-hmm.
So what should the trial court have done here? And what should the Court of Appeals have done? They just said Escalona, right?
Mm-hmm. They did.
Do you support them?
Yes.
But?
I think it's important. You know, Justice Abramson, your question to me was, the state's position is you didn't raise it, so you're out of luck.
I keep reading that.
Of course, because that's the rule of Escalona. But let's be fair to what the actual rule of Escalona is. You're out of luck if you had the opportunity to raise a claim in your direct appeal or in the post-conviction proceedings that may precede the direct appeal. You are prohibited from using 974.06 later to assert a claim that you could have asserted back then, unless you can show good justification for why you didn't. We acknowledge that. Mr. Hennick acknowledges that he is not challenging Escalona, which we had read him to more broadly be challenging, but he concedes that he is not. And moreover, he concedes he does not challenge the correctness of the Court of Appeals decision in Tillman that says the Escalona rule should apply to the no-merit procedure, to those cases where the direct appeal was conducted pursuant to the no-merit procedure, just as it applies to direct cases where a direct appeal was not a no-merit procedure. And in fact, Tillman recognized there may be strong reason why Escalona applies with even greater force in the no-merit context, because in the no-merit context, not only is counsel required to file a report with the court saying, here are conceivable issues that could have been raised, but here's why I don't think they have any merit. And then the court is obliged to conduct an independent examination. And as Mr. Hennick has said, as a result, the defendant has received the benefit of an attorney who, if he or she was performing well, has done a thorough job, and a court that, if it was performing its function mandated by Anders, has conducted a thorough examination of both what counsel said might possibly be involved or what the defendant might raise, and it's concluded it doesn't have anything. So the point is, this is not a situation where we're taking the position, I don't think the state accused is saying, we are taking the position that a defendant is just out of luck. The defendant in the no-merit procedure has had the same opportunity that any defendant in a non-no-merit appeal to bring issues to the attention of his counsel, to say in the discussion on, to be an active participant, an advocate for himself in the confines of the attorney-client relationship, which I think is an obligation that most defendants willingly accept.
Do you know of any retained counsel that files no merits?
No.
No.
No, they're
so
not
I'm
obliged.
Not sure.
They're not obliged to do so.
No. So I'm not sure they're so similarly situated. What all of this case is about, or about a lot of things, but at the heart of this case is a concern that we have for the constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment to be represented by an attorney. Anders discussed this and said, okay, we're going to establish this no-merit procedure because the defendant in this situation has a right to an attorney as an advocate. And so that's their holding, in fact. Look, where's their holding? That's what it says. And so we're going to do the best we can in having an attorney as an, in giving them a right for Sixth Amendment representation by attorney and 14th Amendment. You indicate that unless you can show good justification why you did not raise it on your direct appeal, or I suppose in response, you're out of luck. This is my concern. In the law, we partake in a lot of fictions. And it's necessary sometimes. We draw lines and say this person on this side. And sometimes it's necessary. But I think sometimes the line I draw is right up to here. You know, okay, can I tolerate this fiction? This is the fiction we're dealing with here. Even though a defendant may know what he said to an attorney, maybe he may have said, hey, this witness might say this. Sometimes the defendant, the pro se defendant, isn't going to know the legal theories, isn't going to know the legal issues. And so we engage in this fiction, or your argument engages in the fiction. Unless they know the legal theory early on and raised it, they're precluded. how do we deal with this, the reality of sometimes, I'm not sure about this case, but sometimes they know, may know the events, they may know what they said to the attorney, but they don't realize until years later what the legal implication is. And how can they? How can they necessarily, when the Court of Appeals, after doing an independent review, doesn't know, and when their post-conviction counsel didn't see the legal issue? How can we, in our fiction, hold them to knowing the legal issue early on?
Okay, two responses. One, in the no-merit procedure, I think there is, ironically, less fiction than in the non-no-merit. For the simple reason that the process is more transparent. That is to say, the appointed counsel is obliged under the statute and the Anders procedure to file a no-merit report saying, here's what I've found. The defendant is told, you have the opportunity to respond. Anders says, and our rule says, you can respond and raise any issue you want. This is your opportunity for saying so. So when the case comes before the court, after the completion of that process, the court ought to be able to say, we've been told everything the parties want us to know. Now, will it always be perfect? No. But it's a heck of a lot better, it seems to me, than what routinely happens in the non-indigent circumstance, where, as you have correctly pointed out, Justice Bradley, defense counsel is not obliged to file a no-merit report at all. In fact, you may recall, in Anders, three justices dissenting on the United States Supreme Court said this whole procedure that imposes a requirement to appoint appointed counsel that isn't required of retained counsel is insulting and degrading to appointed attorneys because there's a presumption that they don't do the job that retained attorneys do, and we've got to make them show it. That criticism, the majority of the court did not accept, and Anders remains the law. We have a system that does impose an obligation upon appointed counsel to do something that retained counsel is not required to do. That, frankly, may be the greater fiction, but at least
retained counsel isn't required to do it, because if I retained counsel and he didn't do what I said, he wouldn't be my retained counsel. I would hire another one the next day.
And the client has an opportunity to go and hire a new one, and that's the presumption under which a presumption of good performance is exercised, because it is assumed, surely, without much discussion on the part of the courts, I think, in this area, that precisely because of the freedom to go and hire a new attorney who will do a more satisfactory job, we presume that the system is working well in the retained counsel. And what was being required in Anders was a procedure that would provide the public and the courts, all of society, some assurance that the same kind of advocacy, something close to, if not equal or exceeding, the level of advocacy that retained counsel provided, was also being provided to these attorneys. So, to these defendants. So, whether you have a retained attorney or an appointed attorney, defendants can raise and do raise claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. They do raise claims that my trial counsel or my post-conviction counsel performed deficiently. And in all of those cases, I submit, they are required and should be required to allege facts which, if proved, would establish that point. And this is a requirement that we do not think is being unfairly imposed upon the indigent. It's a requirement that applies to any defendant challenging the effectiveness of counsel.
Mr. Ganster, I always worry that I might get assigned to a case and write the opinion. So I always, a standard question of mine is, how do I write it? So I ask that to you, and there is a Court of Appeals unpublished opinion, mm-hmm. right? And it sets forth the facts and some law. And then at the bottom line is in paragraph 6, right? Mm-hmm. And then says that nothing in 97406 motion that Allen filed suggests that nothing in the record indicates that Allen was, at the time the no merit report was filed unaware of the issues underlying the ineffective assistance of counsel. Although he, that's Allen, blames post-conviction counsel for failing to raise the issues, he offered no reason why he didn't do it in the no merit report. Right? I shortened it, but that's what it says. The simple contention that counsel could have and should have raised this issue is not without more a sufficient reason to overcome Escalona Naranjo. Now, does the state want, if I write the opinion, need to adopt paragraph 6? Would you amend paragraph 6? What do you want us to say?
I think you should adopt the reasoning of, you should incorporate the reasoning of paragraph 6, but along with the court's conclusion that there ought to be a two-part rationale here.
Okay.
One.
So the first part is paragraph 6. Okay, what's the second part?
The defendant has not alleged sufficient reason, has not sufficiently alleged the ineffectiveness of his post-conviction counsel because he has alleged no facts establishing deficient performance. Or he has alleged no facts which, if proven, would show that the performance of his post-conviction counsel was deficient. In essence, he has done what many, footnote to the paragraph I'm suggesting you write. He's done what many defendants, both pro se and represented, do, simply allege in a conclusory fashion some ineffectiveness, and then they look to an evidentiary hearing at which they can present the facts. So basically, their motion becomes a fishing expedition or a discovery attempt. They don't allege the facts that they should put in their motion.
Okay, so
Number two, as to his responsibility, I think it is absolutely fair that the defendant, in the no-merit situation, be asked, why did you, if you did not file a response to the no-merit report, why did you not? Or
that's
if you did
paragraph
file, why
six.
Didn't you? And the reason I think it's fair to impose that requirement is that the Anders procedure in our statute specifically gives the defendant an opportunity to make that response. And Anders made clear, and this court did in McCoy, said the very purpose of having both counsel and the defendant have an opportunity to say what they think is in the case designed to prevent us, the court, from overlooking.
Mr. Ganser, should the court require the defendant be told if you don't raise it now, there's a good shot that you're going to forfeit it?
I think that would be a salutary development.
How does that comport with the Sixth Amendment right to counsel? And waiver, and as 97406 says, a knowing and intelligent waiver.
Of a claim. Yeah, right.
A claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
I don't think that a knowing and intelligent, that the highest level, the Johnson versus Zerp knowing and intelligent voluntary waiver standard, is applicable to the question of whether or not a defendant is waiving the right to raise a particular claim. I just don't find that to be applicable at all. It's too high a waiver standard.
This
court has never interpreted Escalona waiver in that context to be the Johnson versus Zerp's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, fully informed. Now,
Let me just point to sub 4, which 97406.
Yes.
Any ground finally adjudicated or not so raised or knowingly, voluntary, and intelligently waived in the proceeding that resulted in the conviction or sentence or in any other proceeding the person has taken to secure relief may not be the basis for a subsequent motion. So if it is a knowing, voluntary and intelligent waiver under sub 4, it can't be the basis. Is this a knowing, voluntary waiver that you're talking about?
Mr. Hennig has suggested that we're arguing waiver. What we're really arguing under the terminology of 97406 sub 4 is not so raised. The language of the statute is disjuncted. There are different ways in which a person can be barred from raising in a 97406 motion certain issues. What we're relying upon is the basic holding of Escalona, which goes to any claim not so raised in a prior. or knowingly and voluntarily waived is a separate form of, is a separate event which can result on some issues if they were knowingly and voluntarily and intelligently waived, can preclude the defendant from bringing them up. But what we're relying upon is the basic holding of Escalona, which is any issue not raised in a prior direct appeal or post-conviction motion is barred. It's really a procedural bar, not a true waiver in the sense of knowing and
what we call forfeit.
Forfeit would be a good way to refer to it, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Councilman.
Thank you.
Mr. Hammack? Sorry, did you want to have a question, Ms. Justice Brasser? Okay.
Much of the state's argument regarding the ineffectiveness claim is based on a legal mistake on its part. I cite specifically to Smith v. Robbins, from 2000, in which the Supreme Court dealt with the issue of ineffectiveness in a no-merit situation, and specifically held in addressing the issue of whether you have to come up with the attorney's reasons for not raising an arguable issue, is that you don't. All you have to show is that...
I'm talking about the attorney's reasons, counselor, why he didn't raise it. What he's talking about is facts which, if proved, would allow you to prevail. So you have to show you've got a meritorious issue,
yes,
and these facts at least give rise to an argument in that regard. I didn't think he was arguing that the defendant would have to show why counsel didn't raise it.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I think that by saying you have to talk to the lawyer and find out why he didn't raise things, that's exactly what he said.
Well, I think what he said is that wouldn't be a requirement. It might be helpful to put in your motion, if I understood his argument. But what he's saying is there are no facts here that he's raised. And if he had raised facts, which if proved, and they may be proved or not proved, well, then you'd be standing in a position which he would agree would be a reason why Escalona shouldn't apply.
The post-conviction motion, we can look back at the post-conviction motion. I asked the court to do that.
Yeah, well,
and under Smith v. Robbins, first of all, under Smith v. Robbins, the deficient performance prong does not address the reasoning of the lawyer. Rather, with a claim that counsel erroneously failed to file a merits brief, it will be easier for a defendant appellant to satisfy the first part of Strickland. For it is only necessary for him to show that a reasonably competent attorney would have found one non-frivolous issue warranting a merits brief, rather than showing that a particular non-frivolous issue was clearly stronger than other issues that were raised. So the defendant, all he needs to show to meet the requirement for a ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel in a case like this is to show that there, in fact, was at least one non-frivolous issue that was not raised.
How do I know it's non-frivolous? I think that's another way of asking Justice Robinsack's question. He says in his motion that he didn't seek to suppress the fruits of Allen's unlawful arrest. How do I know whether the arrest was lawful or unlawful on the basis of what I have here?
Okay, because the defendant has attached to the motion a part of the discovery shows that, number one, there is an allegation that there was an arrest warrant. And since the defendant was arrested in his bedroom, then we obviously know under Payton v. New York that there would have to be some kind of an arrest warrant. However, the defendant also attached a letter from the court dated in 2005 that says that they can't find any arrest warrant. So the question then is whether, in fact, there is an arrest warrant. And the defendant is saying there appears not to be an arrest warrant. If there is not an arrest warrant, then the arrest is illegal, and therefore the defense attorney was ineffective for not raising it.
So it's your position he did state sufficient facts.
Yes, exactly.
So you're not debating. Are you debating with the state that the state says, let's see what they said, so I don't misstate it, that in order to get past Phase 1, Escalona, or 974-064. One, they've got to articulate why they didn't know, why he didn't know, and why he didn't do it 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Two, he has to make sufficient allegations relating to the ineffectiveness of counsel, stating facts, establishing at least prima facie, or maybe that's not a good word here, that there was deficient performance. So do you object to that as a standard?
But I don't totally understand the standard I think that he is arguing for. I think that we apply the regular Rothering standard, which is that if there's ineffectiveness, then that's sufficient performance. And even if we do apply additional requirements, like why he didn't raise this at the time, that's also clear from the motion.
Okay.
When we look at the attachments, number one, it's a document in discovery. Even today, there is no requirement under 80932 that no merit counsel provide discovery to the defendant. These are motions based on the discovery and actions that the defendant investigated independently, as shown again by the letter from the court from 2005, that could not have been known to the defendant at the time of his no merit brief. He's raising ineffectiveness for not challenging the illegal arrest. That's not going to be clear from the court record. He's challenging his requirement to be involved in a lineup without the assistance of counsel, which of course is unlawful if, in fact, there was an arrest warrant at that time under Wade. And this court has long held that the right to counsel is triggered by an arrest warrant. So either way, there is a viable claim here. And either way, he did not necessarily know that at the time because, as shown in his post-conviction motion, these are things, information that he would not have had at the time of the direct appeal.
So you're not arguing here, really, whether this claim is good or not. That's not what's before us. What is before us only is what the defendant has to do to fit within 974-064 under sufficient reasons.
Exactly.
All right. And your argument is, okay, if the state wants the defendant to explain why he didn't articulate it at these no merit report stage, it's here.
Yes.
If the state wants the defendant to give sufficient reasons for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you're arguing it's here in his motion when you look at the attachments, even if the court has to make some implications of that.
Consistent with Anderson L. and liberally construing pro se.
So I have to go back to writing the opinion. Does this court say, as paragraph 6 says in the Court of Appeals, the defendant has to state why he didn't do it earlier? Do you think that's an essential part?
I'm sorry.
Does the defendant have to state why he did not disagree with the no merit report within the 30 days permitted?
I do not believe that he has to allege that under the 4DA standard. And I would also note that, again, we're talking about pro se individuals. I'm sure this court gets a lot of pro se pleadings, has to try to slog through them. These are not, I deal with a lot of jailhouse lawyers, the ones who actually, for the most part, know the law. I correspond with them. They have a lot of problems, understanding this, and they are probably the top of the people that this court is going to be trying to direct on how to respond to these things. I deal with other lawyers in the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers that sometimes have problems figuring out the procedures. And we're going to be asking, under the state standard or what the court has just asked me, people that may have only a fourth grade education, people who may not speak English. There's not even a requirement that for a Spanish-speaking client that a no-merit brief be translated into Spanish for that individual. But we're asking them to come back and explain all of this. They might not know why. They might not know why they didn't come up with it. They may think that they did. You know, I'm sure that Mr. Allen here thought that he fully explained himself. The state now is picking at it and saying, well, no, you didn't say this, you didn't say this, you didn't say that. But, you know, as the court has recognized, he did a good job in this case compared with what most of the stuff you get from pro se people.
He got our attention.
Yes. And he did it, by the way, when you look at the Court of Appeals brief, he says he did it because he had the assistance of a jailhouse lawyer. He would not have been able to do this himself. So even this case that got to the court, it isn't because Allen, is another James Earl Gideon, you know, who in his handwritten motion to the court got the Supreme Court's attention. Even he had to have the assistance of a jailhouse lawyer, someone who knew more than he did. And if we put a standard that requires everyone to explain this stuff, then there are going to be a lot of people who deserve relief that simply aren't going to get it because they aren't going to understand how to do it. And I would ask for that reason that the court follow the Court of Appeals decision in 40A, do not overturn it. Under the no merit petition procedure, the defendant is entitled to be protected. The procedure is not intended to as a sword against the defendant. And I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick and Mr. Gansner for your excellent arguments on an issue that has befuddled and challenged judges before this, and some of the judges have written opinions saying, hey, this is not clear, we have to do something, and it's never been the case in which we've had to do something, and maybe this is the case that does directly raise the issues that have been presented. And I think your oral arguments have been very helpful, as have your excellent briefs. And the court thanks Ms. Danik as pro bono counsel who took on a bear of a case in which the court knew at the time. And the state's office does its usual good job. Thank you very much to both of you. That ends our hearing on 07-AP-795 State versus Allen. The court is now adjourned in oral argument. Now, Justice Gableman, for just 1 minute, how much time would you like with the students? Because court should go back to conference if it can.
Right.
Before noon.
Well, I know we had the four-hour gap yesterday. I think they've asked for about 45 minutes, Madam Chief Justice.
Okay, then we won't go back. What time do we have?
We have it scheduled for 1:30, Madam Chief Justice.
Yeah. Okay. Then at 1:30, we will be in administrative conference. The court will not reconvene in closed conference until after the administrative conference.